What a crowd.
Thank you all for coming.
And I certainly deeply appreciate your willingness to dive into this text, a text by Dogen.
As I think Kate mentioned a little bit in the introductory remarks, it's just once a year that we offer this kind of format, a kind of chance to study together, to sit together, and to really kind of reflect on one of these kind of challenging Zen texts. And usually we pick something from Dogen to see really what it says to us, and to hear a little bit what our Zen ancestors tell us, what experience, knowledge they're passing on to us through their writings. And to see if it's helpful, if this will help us as we make our way in the world. Let me just encourage you to please be comfortable. If you want to get an extra chair or whatever, stretch your legs out. This is not a formal talk. We're a little bit more informal, so it is fine to, relax. But don't relax too much. But please do be comfortable. Have you noticed how sleepy Saturday morning Zazen is? After a week of perhaps work, Saturday morning can feel like, oh, yeah.
Perhaps work.
Or maybe it's the late Friday nights, I don't know. It's the younger people that make it a little bit sleepier. So unlike usual retreats, as Kate mentioned, there will be, four talks and discussion and some exercise that we'll be doing together throughout the retreat. But, of course, still a fair bit of sitting, because this is what really supports us. And I think the sitting will also help us understand and perhaps clarify a little bit as we kind of read Dogen and think about it. Dogen. I thought I'd say a few words about this character just before we launch into the text, because some people may not be that familiar. So Dogen was born in, I think, in the year 1200. In Japan, and at a very young age, his mother died. And that had a very powerful effect on him and led him to want to enter the religious life at that time. And of course, at that time, Buddhism was the main way that people would pick up religious practices. There was, of course, indigenous religion there as well, but Buddhism particularly, brought forward this idea of death within Japanese society, making it possible for people to really contemplate and think of and deal with. So Dogen, I think he was 12 or 13, roughly, then began to religious practice, entering a monastery, training fairly rigorously. And at some point during all this training, he felt it wasn't quite enough. And there was a new form of Buddhism entering in Japan, the kind that we recognize as Zen today, or Chan from China. He started to practice with a teacher this new form of Buddhism. And eventually, he decided he needed to go to China to really understand what this new form of Buddhism was. And so he did. As a young man, he traveled to China with his then teacher, and he lived in China and practiced there for several years, not a great number of years, I think 3 or 4, I can't remember exactly, 5. And in China, he met what he called his true teacher, the teacher who could really show him, or at least that's when Dogen felt he really understood the Dharma. He then came back to Japan and began to teach. And in a very paradoxical way, you know, in Zen we have this saying, you know, that it's true transmission outside the scriptures, beyond words. Dogen wrote a lot. He wrote quite a bit, as did many Zen teachers. And the Zen canon is quite large. Quite large.
Michael, are you talking about the Japanese Zen canon?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. The Chinese one is quite large too, but the Japanese one is, you know, many of the teachers left a lot of writing for us to chew on. Now, just before we get into the text itself, I thought I'd talk a little bit about how we read a religious text. In this case, it's really complicated because the original text is written in a foreign language, and written in a foreign language, you know, that comes from the 13th century. So there are challenges already there. So we can't really approach it like we would approach, you know, reading something light that we keep on our bedside table before we go to bed. Or, you know, even a book on Buddhism by a contemporary Zen teacher, like Thich Nhat Hanh or some other teacher like that. We can't read the text that way. We can't simply read it and expect to understand it. We need to consider a little bit the background, historical setting, some of the references that appear, maybe even what was Dogen struggling with himself at that time. But also, we need to really consider what we are bringing ourselves to this text as we look at it. And this is especially important in this text that we're going to be looking at, because it's about enlightenment, whatever that may be, or awakening, which is something I think we all have notions about. We've all heard, if not thought about, or struggled with these ideas of awakening, enlightenment. Maybe we've had some past experiences that maybe we think may be intimations of enlightenment, or things certainly we've discussed or read in books. So as we work through this text, discovering, I hope, at least to some extent, what Dogen meant when he wrote it, I'd like us to really notice feelings of agreement and disagreement that arise. I'd like us particularly to notice the confusion and understanding. And when we notice them, just put them aside. And ask yourself, is there some clarity here about what Dogen is writing about? And asking ourselves as we go through this, how this text may inform our practice and inform our approach to our life. In other words, please engage with this text. Engage it, of course, with our minds, but also with our hearts. And try not to let your reactions or confusion or responses obscure the text itself. A kind of openness as we approach this. So to start us off, I'm going to give you a little exercise to do first. And I don't think I have quite enough of these, but I think it will be okay, because I'll give some paper to people who will write these words. Kevin, can you give me one? If you would, please. Yeah, good. Okay. So maybe a couple of people are going to have to share.
Let's wait and see who falls short.
And then we need pens.
Pens this way.
And part of the reason I wanted to do this at this juncture was for each of us to have a little bit of clarity or bring forward our kind of simple understanding of what some of these words mean to us when we hear them. And with that understanding, then maybe I think it will be a little easier to understand what Dogen may be telling us and what he wants to express by using some of this language and some of these words. The words are a big problem. Words can be a big problem. The title of the text that I'm going to pass out in just a moment in Japanese is Daigo, which means great or complete awakening, complete enlightenment, complete realization. It's a relatively short essay within this collection of texts called the Shobo Genzo. I think it's the 27th chapter or fascicle within this. And the Shobo Genzo is a collection of Dogen's writings, you know, over 60 essays that he wrote, collected together. And in English, when you translate the whole thing, it's like two big fat volumes to go through. When he wrote this text, this Daigo, this was a period of time when he wrote a lot. I think he wrote this in 1242, and during that year he also wrote 17 other essays. So it was a time when, for him, not that long after he'd come back from China, he was really productive in his writing. And he was writing mostly for the monks and nuns that were training under him, and also to a certain extent lay people, but mostly focusing, I think, on people he was training with. Now, 1242, just the number, right, for most of us. Well, just to put it a little bit into historical context, this was the time of the Crusades. This was the beginning of the Inquisition in Europe. This was the time when the Mongols had conquered and ruled most of Asia, including parts of Europe, right? The great Mongol Empire, Genghis Khan. And in Japan, this was the beginning of a period of time known as the Kamakura period. And it was a time of relative peace after a very long and very bloody civil war. That finally a new government had established itself and Japan was again unified. But that bloody war was still in much in living memory. So this text, Daigo, composed in 1242, when Dogen was living in a temple, kind of his first real temple that he was in charge of, with people living with him that he was training, a temple called Koshoji, just a little bit south of the capital at that time, which was Heian.
Now Kyoto.
Yeah, now Kyoto. And of course, the original buildings are long gone. In Japan, almost all the buildings were built of wood, and a few have remained, but most of them, of course, were subject to earthquakes and fires over the centuries. But Kosoji was rebuilt several times, and it's now located in a town called Uji, which is south of Kyoto, a little bit further than the original Kosoji. And Kate and I went there a number of years ago. And very famous because it has a Chinese-style temple gate, very unusual. But Dogen had come back from China, and not that he built the gate or anything, but it's kind of, I think, that connection to China. And it's still a place of training today. Monks train there. It's a smaller temple. But if you go to Japan, that's, I think, one of the must-see sites of Dogen when you do your Dogen pilgrimage.
Okay, so I'll pass the text out in just a moment. The title, as I mentioned, literally translates as Great Enlightenment or Complete Enlightenment, Complete Awakening. The character Dai, the first part means big or great or complete. And Go, the Go of Daigo in Japanese, is also read as Satori, which is a word some of us are familiar with if you've read Zen text, Satori, meaning awakening or enlightenment. Now, enlightenment has come to be the English word that for most of the Buddhist literature seems to represent the religious experience that Buddha had, you know, all those many centuries ago under the Bodhi tree. But frankly, I don't like it. I don't like the word enlightenment. It started to be used in this context in Buddhism in the 1800s, when the early translators of Buddhist texts from those Sanskrit and Chinese were translating now into European languages, right? So the 1800s is when this really got going. And they were trying to translate the word Bodhi. And Bodhi literally means to awake. But the translators of that time were really interested and I think partly enthralled by the European philosophers. And, you know, the time of enlightenment, Immanuel Kant, for example, used that word a lot in his writings, meaning that enlightenment was a person's release from his self-inflicted tutelage. I'm not exactly sure what Immanuel Kant meant by all that, but he was very popular, and the word enlightenment was in the air, and so it was used. I think what it means is we kind of think we can't understand unless someone else tells us something. I think that was his idea. We need to be free of being told what to do and how to do it. But the word enlightenment really doesn't connect to the Sanskrit word or the Pali word of that idea of to awake, to literally to wake up from sleep. In the Sanskrit, Bodhi, or the Pali, doesn't mean like a flashlight goes on or a light bulb turns on and there's this kind of deep understanding. It's more like when we wake up from sleep, you know, that kind of a slower kind of gradual understanding of entering into the world, seeing the true world, as opposed to living in the dream world. So I think awakening or realization is a better word to use, and that's a word that I'm going to be using from now on. So let me now, I've whetted your appetite, I hope, a little bit. And I think I have 24 copies here. I hope this will do, and if not, we can get some more for a little bit later. Okay, so the Zen tradition is to spend the first week of Dharma talks talking about the title of a text. But I won't do that. Although I will say the term Daigo itself is a Buddhist term found both in Chinese and Japanese texts. And the meaning is to kind of have penetrating insight into the true nature of things. Penetrating insight into the true nature of things. And so in the texts, Chinese and Japanese texts, it's the word that indicates a kind of experience that overcomes delusion and reveals a truth. So
kind of a way that we're perhaps very familiar with it. And it appears a lot in Zen koans, the Chinese Zen koans that come from the Tang Dynasty. I'm sure many of you are familiar with those as well. These kind of short stories about strong awakenings, many of them refer to. A few words, a shout from the teacher, a pulled nose, right? A finger raised, and it's usually this finger, not the middle finger. And then students suddenly experience great awakening. So here's one example, just in case you're not familiar with koans. So the student Taishan used to come to the master Longtan in the evenings to talk and to listen. And one night, it was very late, before he had finished asking all his questions. "Why don't you go to bed?" asked Longtan. He's the master, right? Longtan, the master, asked. Taishan bowed and lifted the screen to go out, kind of like a bamboo screen, like to keep mosquitoes out. They would lift, you know, left to go out. "The hall is dark," he said. "Here, take this candle," said Longtan, lighting one for the student. Taishan reached out his hand and took the candle. Longtan leaned forward and blew it out. And at that moment, Taishan had sudden great realization and bowed. Well, if it was only that easy. So those are the kind of stories. And in the 50s and 60s, D.T. Suzuki, the great Japanese scholar and Zen practitioner, first introduced Zen to a really wide audience, particularly in the West, in North America, but also in Europe, through his lectures. But particularly through his very influential writings on Buddhism and on Rinzai Zen, which is the kind of Zen that he practiced, this kind of koan Zen. And I read, and maybe some of you did too, quite a bit of his writings when I was younger. And much of it does focus on satori, on this idea of awakening, or these experiences. And certainly in the Rinzai tradition, Kensho or Satori refer to religious experiences of awakening. And many Rinzai teachers consider these kind of experiences as really crucial to following the Buddhist path. You have to have some kind of awakening experience. So I think, thanks in large part to D.T. Suzuki, this kind of flash of insight model of awakening that we find in the Rinzai tradition became pretty widely known amongst people who are interested in Buddhism at all. But when we look at Buddhist texts in general, like leaving aside the Rinzai stuff, the Buddhist traditions refer to the awakening of the Buddha, but there's great variation as to what that awakening means. Great variation. So just to give you an example of a totally different tradition, Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai forest Buddhist teacher, a monk in that tradition, he gave this definition, and he used the word nirvana, which I won't go into the whole quote, but he says, you know, awakening and nirvana are the same. But this is what he says about nirvana. He says, and I'll use the word, he uses nibbana, which is the Pali. Nibbana means not grasping. Nibbana means not giving meaning to things. Nibbana means letting go. Making the mind clear. Clear of self-cherishing, clear of concepts of self and other. And for not wishing for anything. Not wishing to be or become anything. This is Nibbana. It's a very different language to describe this experience. Letting go.
letting go. So, one more quote. A little closer to home, this is from Shinryu Suzuki, who is the Japanese Zen priest who brought this form of Soto Zen practice to North America, particularly San Francisco, that's founded the San Francisco Zen Center, where our tradition comes from. So this is what he wrote. I think quite interesting as well. Before Bodhidharma, this is Bodhidharma is the monk who brought the Zen tradition from India into China, at least legendarily. Before Bodhidharma, people thought that after a long preparation, sudden enlightenment would come. Thus, Zen practice was a kind of training to gain enlightenment. Actually, many people today are practicing Zazen with this idea. But this is not the traditional understanding of Zen. The understanding passed down from Buddha to our time is that when you start Zazen, there is enlightenment even without any preparation. Whether you practice Zazen or not, you have Buddha nature. Because you have it, there is enlightenment in your practice. The points we emphasize are not the stage we attain, but the strong confidence we have in our original nature and the sincerity of our practice. We should practice Zen with the same sincerity as Buddha. If originally we have Buddha nature, the reason we practice Zazen is that we must behave like Buddha. So again, a little bit different understanding, a little different approach to this idea of awakening. It's already here. As we start looking at this text, Great Awakening, keep in mind that Dogen has his own sense of this word, and I hope it will become clear as we work our way through this. In a sense, he says in his opening lines, Great Awakening springs beyond Buddhas and ancestors. Springs beyond Buddhas and ancestors. Kind of cool. I'll come back to that. So I think clearly for Dogen here, Great Awakening is not merely a state of knowledge that overcomes delusion, let alone a kind of momentary leap of insight. It seems rather to be a basic condition, a fundamental way of being that is shared not only by Buddhas and us deluded beings, but by all things, as we'll see a little bit later in the text, by earth, water, fire, wind, and space, by columns and lanterns, by the snowy mountains, by the rocks and trees. Such great awakening, he says, is without origin. It fills the ditches and clogs the gullies of our world. So I ask you, what the heck is he talking about? So maybe it's time to now pick up the text and let's do it this way. Kevin, let's start reading one sentence, and we'll just kind of go around the back area first. We'll come around this way. We won't get that far, but just read one sentence, and once we get through the end of paragraph one, then I'll say a few words.
The great way of the Buddhas is handed down carefully and continuously.
Oh, thank you. I should mention,
in almost all of these fascicles or chapters of Dogen, he usually, the first paragraph is a real tough nut. And he tries to usually introduce the main ideas all at once in the first paragraph. And then he begins to unpack it a little bit throughout. So don't despair yet. So the great way of the Buddhas is handed down carefully, continuously. The meritorious deeds of the ancestors are manifest everywhere openly. So from the time of Buddha up to the present, the deep understanding of reality, or the great way, has been passed down from generation to generation with full attention and with care. And yet, this is nothing special. The work or activities of our ancestors and the Buddha is not special or unique. It is manifested broadly, without discrimination, everywhere. Nothing is hidden, nothing is kept secret. We'll come back and consider, what is this great way? What does Dogen mean here by the great way? Is it the practices and understandings of Buddha and the ancestors? Is it something beyond that? Is it our own practice, this great way, our own life? Is it simply the reality of all things, the great way? Therefore, great awakening appears. Unawakened, one reaches the way. Aware of awakening, one plays with awakening. Losing awakening, one acts freely. This is one of my favorite lines. Great awakening appears. I think in this sentence, great awakening refers to the Mahayana teaching that everything is connected. Everything is always here in one seamless moment. Our daily life, we see everything as separate little bits. In great awakening, we see the seamlessness of everything. In Mahayana Buddhism, there's a beautiful image of Indra's net. Are you familiar with that? It's this image that appears in writings, particularly in China. Let me read you a description of what the Indra's net is. This is by a scholar named Francis Cook, who wrote a lot about this particular understanding. At any rate, so this is Indra's net. Far away in the heavenly abode of the great god Indra, there is a wonderful net which has been hung by some cunning artificer in such a manner that it stretches out indefinitely in all directions. In accordance with the extravagant tastes of the deities, it was hung with a single glittering jewel at the net's every node. So every where it crosses, right? Every node, there's a glittering jewel there. And since the net is infinite in dimension, the jewels are infinite in number. There, hanging the jewels, glittering like stars of the first magnitude, a wondrous sight to behold. If we arbitrarily select one of these jewels for inspection and look at it closely, we will discover that in its polished surface, there are reflected all the other jewels of the net, infinite in number. Not only that, but each of the jewels reflected in this one jewel is also reflecting all the other jewels, so that the process of reflection is infinite. As each gem reflects every other one and everything else in the universe, so you affect everyone and every other system in the universe. Great awakening appears. Great because it is awakening to the way things are, to the true nature of the world, without this, the distorting lens of our stories. So here, I think great awakening is simply the true nature of all things, the entire reality without division. The great Indra's net. Everything interconnected. But that's not enough. Our practice as an individual must go beyond that sense of I and our kind of concepts of awakening. That I have or do not have a realization. One attains great awakening only through delusion. Only through the seemingly unawakened place that we stand can we awaken. So here is a hint, I think, at Dogen's understanding of the relationship or this tension between great awakening and delusion. We think, don't we? Once I get there, that's the end of delusion. But Dogen is telling us something radically different here. And we'll come back to that. So, fully immersed in this great awakening, this great Indra's net, this interconnectedness, there is nothing separate. So, in a sense, it's beyond awakening. Because in awakening, nothing is left out. How can there even be awakening? You can't stand outside and say, oh, awakening. Because there's nothing to point at. Everything is part of this Indra's net. If everything is part of Indra's net, what do you look at? Who points? There's no one to stand outside and recognize awakening as awakening. Now, did you ever think of that? I'll know when I'm awakened. But if you're awakened, then it's like to everything, like there's suddenly you're not there to point at it anymore. That's why through all the years, the Zen masters have said, if you think you're awakened, you're not there yet. Following this logic, there is no awakening or delusion, as there's really nothing to compare it to. So even to say that one, that everything is one, is to kind of invite misconception, because one implies two or more, right? So we let go. We let go by sitting upright in Zazen. We let go of our comparing and judging by entering as fully as we can into this present moment. We let go. Do you remember when you first learned to ride a bicycle? How challenging it was to kind of keep the balance, you know, and your hands, you know, the brakes and your feet pedaling, keep upright, steering, trying to travel in a straight line. Really hard, right? At least it was hard for me for a while. And then suddenly, after some practice and maybe falling off the bicycle several times, the body seems to take over. And without coordinating our hands and feet, we just let go. and we ride freely. Dogen here is telling us, as when we hang on to this idea of awakening and realization, or even onto an experience we've had of awakening or realization, we can't use it. If we hang on to it, we can't use it. Only by letting go are we able to play and use it freely. And yet, he says, these are everyday matters among the Buddhas and ancestors. This playing and letting go of great awakening is not special. It's every day. Just as our everyday activities, when we do those with deep presence, we're fully there. Cooking, changing diapers, walking the dog, zazen, all of these activities are the activities of Buddhas and ancestors. These are our activities. So he's telling us, I think, kind of a crucial teaching here, that only by losing our awakening, or our ideas of awakening, can we really act freely. Can we really bring it forward in the world? Okay. And maybe let's pause here. First of all, any questions? Okay.
I do have a question about those words. Is there a difference between satori and kensho?
Yeah. Technically, there is Kensho is considered to be a smaller experience. Satori, a larger experience in the Rinzai tradition. Yeah. So now, what I'd like us to do... Sorry. Yeah, sorry.
May I? Teacher, I'm embarrassed to say that I still don't understand delusion.
Please don't be embarrassed. I think we're all not sure what delusion means. And we all have different ideas. But let me say this. For Dogen, delusion, he's using the word to mean that everything is separate. Our everyday view of the world as things being separate and unconnected in any kind of meaningful way. That's delusion, from Dogen's understanding. So in other words, you know, I'm Michael, you know, Kate's Kate. Yeah, we meet and we talk and there's a little bit of connection there, but you know, basically we're two separate things. But Dogen's saying that, and that's delusion. But that's how we operate our life, and that's what causes us suffering. The great delusion within Buddhism is that we are separate. And because of that, all kinds of confusion arises. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask?
Yep.
When I read